Thank you very much for all being here. So as Wendy explained, I'm going to present you work that I've been doing in order to define openness for life science databases. And I've been working on this project as part of my double fellowship of this year, both at the Brookman Center and at Science Commons. And I'm happy to have several Science Commons representatives in the room. So before describing you the projects on which we worked this year, I will give you a bit of historical background. Concretely, it all started, at least for me, in November 2004 at the French National Parliament. What happened there? Actually, it was the launch of the Creative Commons licenses in France, and I've been involved on this project. And the keynote that Creative Commons had sent us to present Creative Commons in France, in addition to the French experts that we had invited, was John Wilbanks. And it was the very beginning of Science Commons, but he made such a great impression, nobody noticed that it was the beginning of the project, and the whole audience had really a great impression of that project. And I remember something that John said at that time, where we were considering Creative Commons licenses for creative works, maybe for educational works, public sector information, but it hadn't struck us yet that some work regarding openness and more open access conditions than applicable law by default would also be needed for scientific data. And John had this story about comparing diseases and culture, and said something in a more funny and elaborate way, of course, I'm sorry, that you actually don't die from malaria if you can't remix music. So it's different perspectives. Both works are very important, but for scientific data, there are more requirements and the perspective is different, and that's why Creative Commons had this project on for the sharing of scientific data and material called Science Commons. So a lot of work was led at Science Commons between 2004 and 2007. So what happened in 2007? Many project leads working on international projects of Creative Commons were gathering on beautiful beaches in Croatia for the annual get-together of Creative Commons and iCommons community. And we had to take a decision about licenses versioning. Because what we did around 2004, before Science Commons led this huge amount of research and work on what should be the requirement to open up access to data and databases, what did we do in Europe? Well, we copied each other. So I think that the French copied the Dutch, the Belgian copied the Dutch too, or something like that. And so finally, the Creative Commons licenses ported into European law had a clause about database sui generis rights. So what's that? This is a legal protection for databases, which creates an additional level of protection and of complexity, as if copyright law was not complex enough, and it's specific to Europe. And we were thinking that as we were opening copyright and providing more open solution, it should be also a reasonable solution to propose to database producers also to open up and give more freedoms and more flexibility on these rights. However, it happens that we were kind of wrong as far as scientific databases are concerned. So I will not go into all the details of these findings, because there are many great papers on the topics that you can read on Science Commons websites, and especially the frequently asked questions. But this was something that had to be taken into account, the Creative Commons licenses, in order to support open science and the scientific commons. Then the next meeting between Science Commons and Creative Commons International community and other scientific community happened last September, again in Paris. And so Science Commons presented their findings about the best way to deal with data and scientific databases as opposed to creative works and information in general. And discussion which we collectively led at this meeting in September led to the development of Science Commons Open Data Protocol. So, unlike to the Creative Commons licenses, who I guess you all know about, it is not a license, it is not a set of legal tools. It is a methodology in order to reach databases interoperability. So what do I mean? What do we mean by databases interoperability? So one of the purpose of all this work is to be able not to remix music, but to remix and do mashups with scientific data and databases, data sets, aggregate, integrate thousands of databases and have the semantic web perform more powerful queries and processings on scientific data and knowledge that one single researcher or one single team could process without all this technology. So what are the requirements in order to make the best use of all the scientific knowledge embedded in the thousands of data and scientific databases available around the world on the web and not on the web yet? So there are basically three sets of requirements legally. The conditions attached to describing the access to databases and scientific data must be simple. They must be predictable, they must be understandable, they must not lead to legal uncertainty. First point. Second point, controls should be waived, because for instance, if you want to retain commercial use on your data or your databases, or the right to make derivatives, it may prevent a lot of usages, like processing, use of automated softwares, work with commercial companies. So restrictions are not good. restrictions can be of different natures. They can be related to copyright. They can be related to this European database producers' generis rights. But they can also be related to contracts and licenses. So the set of legal restrictions can be really diverse, but there are also technical restrictions which have to be waived. So I advise you to have a look at the Science Commons protocol. It builds upon several definitions of open knowledge and open access. So it is compliant with the open knowledge definition, which was developed by the Open Knowledge Foundation. It is also an extension of the definition which was developed, I think, 10 years ago by the Budapest Open Access Initiative to open access to scientific literature. So, when we started the project I'm presenting today about life science databases, the goal was to work on open data in order to define requirements and evaluate which are the freedoms and which are the restrictions which are currently applying to scientific data, and how it would be possible to so concretely implement the protocol and more broadly help database curators, if they wish to do so, to be more open and remove controls. So what we did is first identify a set of databases in life science. So as it is described on the webpage of the luncheon, and also as of today or tomorrow, you will be able to read the whole paper with all the findings, the links, the conclusions. So we worked on a set of scientific databases. First, we took databases from the molecular biology database hosted by the Nucleic Acid Research Journal, which contains 1,000 of databases, and I had a look at random terms of use because I like reading terms of use. It's a bit weird, but I like, what I really like to is not read them entirely, but parse them quickly in order to see if I can understand them. Because I assume that not a majority of people read them entirely, and it's important to know if they are understandable. Not only because of the protocol, but a little bit too. So I identified a couple of legal and technical restrictions which were applying to these databases. So first, the legal restrictions in the terms of use, in the policies which governs the access, the reuse, and the integrations of data hosted in that repository. And second, technical restrictions which may apply to the processing of these databases. So it's very important to not only look for open access at economic condition, it has to be free like in free beer, or in legal conditions, it has to be free of legal and contractual controls, but also at technical restrictions. These hidden transaction costs which may prevent you from downloading the whole set of data and do all the processing that scientists need to do. So based on these restrictions, a taxonomy was built and metadata were produced. So I am refraining from showing you the whole taxonomy and the whole set of metadata because they don't fit on one slide, and I was told to not put too many texts on slides. But don't worry, I will read them to you. We will have a look at the user interface and hopefully you will read the paper afterwards. So the conclusion of the work, I will show you the research and the user interface in a minute, is that only 20%, one-fifth of the databases of a second subset of life science databases that we analyzed were considered to be in the public domain. So, yes?
Quick question. I mean, was the premise in choosing this set of databases that they were supposedly in the public domain? Or?
There was an indication on the website that this website was under a Creative Commons license.
So everything in theory. I'm trying to make the 20% number more surprising.
Like it was, we didn't really know.
Yeah.
We didn't really know. It wasn't really quite clear. And that was also the goal of the project, to see
the initial set, there's an annual review published in the microbiology world of they're called the major databases. There's about 1,000 of those.
Right.
So those are the core molecular biology databases for just doing science, sort of generic to licensing. There's a vital subset of that, which is about 200, which was the actual research set. So sort of saying, you know, what are the, are these things saying they're in the public domain? It's more, how easy is it to integrate the critical databases in the life sciences? That was sort of the research question.
Got it.
So here you can have a look at the interface which was developed by my colleague Shirley Fung, who can't be here unfortunately today because she's moving. So hi Shirley, I hope you're participating online. So based on the taxonomy, we developed a set of questions to evaluate technical accessibility and legal accessibility of these databases. So first step, does the database provide a link to download the whole database? This is important because if you can only access the data through other features, other processing systems like queries or batch features, it means that you can't do whatever you want with those data. It can be useful totally for some usages and some searches, but definitely not for everything. Another question was whether it was required to register before accessing data. Then for the legal accessibility, the first question was, does the database have a policy? So you could assume that yes, but actually no. Many databases don't have a policy. They don't have terms of use, and thus by default, you don't know what you are allowed to do with them. So it's really unclear, and so John explains the rationale of the project for Science Commons, and one of the scientific goals and within my own research agenda was to understand how terms of use are applied, are needed, can be built, should be simplified, etc. Basically, how can terms of use foster creativity and innovation? So this was the question that I applied in this project. There is actually a sub-question to this question. Does the database have a policy? It means, is the policy understandable? And I have a little story about that. So first, I thought that I could analyze hundreds of terms of use, but actually it was a little bit too much, so we reduced the subset, and also we seeked some help. And one afternoon, we sat together with Carolina Rossini, and we had a look at some terms of use. Of course, it would be very nice to have four legal eyes on this database terms of use. It would avoid to have to do some checking for mistakes afterwards, and also we were looking forward to having some fun, I guess. Actually, it wasn't so fun because we were expecting to immediately agree, like one looks one term of use, the other one looks another, 1 minute after we compare results. Of course I agree. But it wasn't the case. And it revealed that those terms of use are really not simple to understand. If we happen to have contradictory opinions on the interpretation of these terms of use regarding the taxonomy, which was not really complicated. Is the policy public domain, or are there restrictions? If yes, which restrictions? So the taxonomy was intending to be easy in order to be used by other people than me, than the team, but it didn't work like that. So one of the main findings of this research was that many terms of use don't have a policy, if by policy we say clear terms defining what scientists can do or not do with data. Then we were having a look at the restrictions, and in order to qualify a database as open in the public domain, the policy has to be simple, clear, understandable, and also has to clearly dedicate data to the public domain. Otherwise, if there are contractual restrictions, such as contractual requirements for attribution, which can sometimes be really complicated and go well further beyond usual practices and norms of attribution in scientific community. This is a legal restriction, because imagine if you aggregate 1,000 of databases and you forgot to attribute one, and this is clearly described in the protocol, then you could be held contractually liable for not respecting attribution. Limitation of the usages of the databases to non-commercial uses only is also a restriction. It's really not appropriate. Prohibition or restriction on modifying data, several databases, I was really surprised. Explain in their terms of use that, sure, you're free to copy data and redistribute that, but you can't modify them. So this is really not helpful for science. So these are the questions before reaching the 20% that were processed, that were applied to a subset of these databases. Then, if I can go to the next slide. So the user interface, which is on so the project website, presents the databases which were analyzed according to their technical accessibility and their legal accessibility statutes. And when they are in the public domain, meaning you can download them, the whole database, without a registration, there is a policy, it is in the public domain. We provide the link to the policy for those who want to have a little fun, and a link to download the whole database for the scientists who want to do the serious work. And we hope that others will use our interface and methodology to either check which databases are really open, which data are really in the public domain, and eventually add and describe the status regarding to public domain of other databases. So Shirley applied a whole set of possibilities to browse through our results. You can have a look at those which have a policy, at those which are in the public domain. And this is the most interesting, the last finding. On a subset on around 60 databases, some of them which don't even contain data, but sometimes journals, articles, so they were out of our scope, only 7 databases are in the public domain, because you can download them without registration, they have a policy, they are in the public domain. So, going back to our results, if you want to have a look at the paper, you will see that, so we are also proposing for the 80% of databases which are not in the public domain, a checklist in order to help the database curators who want to do so, because some of them may not be aware that the terms of use that they put or the user interface that they propose prevent some usages, so prevent the full access and processing to their data. So there are 7 or 8 questions for database curators. Do you provide a link to download the whole database? Do you provide a policy expressing terms of use of your database and other questions like that? And in order your database to be qualified as in the public domain, you have to answer yes, 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 everywhere. Otherwise, it doesn't work. You're not in the public domain. So this is Check Your Data Freedom guidelines. So what are the next steps to this research within Science Commons open data projects. So first, open up the user interface, the website, to others. So today is officially the launch of the beta of the project. And hopefully some scientists will find the project useful in order to know at a glance which databases are really open without having to look at the terms of use, without having to discuss during 2 hours if it really means that there are no restrictions or if there is a hidden legal restriction.
No, and even if they can't find, because sometimes we had to click through 10 times in the site to find a term of use that would be applied for that data. So the information is really not findable sometimes.
Yes. So where was I? So maybe other scientists will add data on other databases, such as, for instance, a repository for open access journals, which was developed by Sherpa Romeo, and which actually assesses terms of use, not terms of use, but publishing policies of open access journals. And as an author of scientific paper, you can find out in 2 minutes if you are allowed to reuse your own paper. So this is a possibility. Also, the taxonomy and the metadata may be operationalized and formalized into an ontology and become part of CCREL. So what is CCREL? It stands for Creative Commons Rights Expression Language, and it is a machine-readable version of the Creative Commons licenses options. And what's the goal of a rights expression language? It helps machine to access to data which, for instance, in our case, are in the public domain. So I would like to now have a discussion with you. And so I have one conclusion and one possible path to go and have further work. So this year at the Berkman Center, we discussed a lot. We did a lot of work on open access to scientific literature. So in February, Stuart Schieber at the Faculty of Arts and Science did this great proposal to the faculty of having the faculty giving a mandate on their articles to the faculty, so that to the university, so that the university can give access to the faculty literatures and open up them on open access repository. And a few months later, other faculty directors of the Berkman Center did the same for the law school. And so I was wondering whether, after working on removing barriers and incentives to offering open access to scientific publications, one of the next research points that Berkman and other folks could be working on would be how to remove barriers and provide incentives to scientists to provide open access to scientific data. So that's it. Thank you.
to the scientists to provide open access to their data? Do you have any?
I'm sorry, I can't hear you.
Is it even up to the individual scientists whether they can allow open access to their data? Or do you have any sense for even basic research that would otherwise be in the open domain? How much of that is prevented from entering the open domain because the researchers have taken funding from, say, military establishments around the world?
I didn't hear the last sentence.
Oh, how much of the data, say, from basic research that would otherwise be in the public domain is prevented from getting into the public domain because the researchers have accepted funding from military establishments around the world, those sorts of things?
It's a good question. I have absolutely no idea. But so opening access to data can be a decision of the researcher, but it can also be a decision of the funding institution. So in the same way that NIH and European funders may require or recommend researchers who benefit from their funding to deposit their publications immediately or after a short period in an open access institutional repository, the same could happen to scientific data. So the funder policy is one possibility. The faculty mandate, like it's been happening here at Harvard, is another possibility. But first, it can be a decision of the individual researcher or of the research team.
Yes? There's a couple of axes that this tends to cut on. So one is discipline specific. So physicists tend to share everything, right? Because there's only a couple of super colliders in the world. You have to share access, but it's sort of like timeshare computing, right? But to these giant super colliders in the world. Biologists share very little in comparison. So you can sort of, that's one of the axes, is does the discipline sort of encourage you? Another one is scope of the project. So big collaborative projects tend to be open public domain, regardless of the discipline. The human genome is one good example of that, but there's the Hubble, there's any number of these things. And as you get down towards the medium-sized projects, those go typically into curated databases, and that's the level at which Melanie was really doing the research, is that mid-size databases that tend to store this stuff. At the small scale, there's almost no sharing. Completely scientist-driven decision. When it comes to military funding, we don't know how much doesn't get shared because that data never actually makes it out into the light of day. But it doesn't tend to affect biology so much here. They've locked up a lot of nanotech. They've locked up a lot of advanced AI, text mining, voice recognition kind of stuff. And they've locked up a lot of this emerging synthetic biology, which is using biology to write biological programs. On the flip side, the military does an enormous amount of infectious disease research on Ebola and Marburg viruses, which is all completely open access and public domain. So it's hard to make generalizations, but you can have some sort of matrices that let you start to segment projects by how likely the researcher is to have control.
Steve, I think, raised his hand first.
Forward question. How do you make sure that as all of these different databases out there in the world are updated and maybe their terms of services are changing or splitting in unexpected ways, is this just a huge sort of administrative task of continuing to return to the terms of service?
That's a very good point, and that's why we need to open the work to external users in order to appreciate the freshness of the terms of use and also of the data, as we were indeed discussing last week at Science Commons, because if data, being the project data, the legal qualification stuff, or the scientific data, if they are not updated, they don't mean anything. They're useless.
As a user, I want to be able to trust.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, and that's why. So we need to have a field for comments, because if the data are not annotated, then you don't know if they're valid.
And then I guess my follow-up to that would be, is there any way to get buy-in from people who are creating and maintaining these databases to sort of actively push to you, here's a clearer articulation of our terms of service for machine reading?
Yeah, this would be a possibility, because some terms of use are really unclear, or when there are no terms of use, it's really not a solution. And obviously, the terms of use were not the main concern of the scientists when they put their databases out there. But I remember this one website which was all black, and it made really difficult to browse and have the link, and I wanted to add a category. Not browsable, not convenient, bad design, technically not accessible. It was a database about bugs. I almost wanted to email them. But, well, I couldn't start, because if I had started, I would have had to. Yeah. Ethan?
I'm interested in this question of looking for data to be public domain as opposed to licensed under some other form of license. And this isn't my field, and so when I get this wrong, I'm sure someone's going to jump in and correct me. But my understanding was, within Creative Commons, there was initially a push to have people have public domain to be an option for a work. Creative Commons started de-emphasizing that because there was the fear that if something was put into the public domain, someone else could then take it and re-copyright it. Is there a similar concern with scientific data? If there is a similar concern, why is the push specifically for this to be public domain rather than under some sort of extremely non-restrictive Creative Commons license to provide as much open access as possible?
Because even the less restrictive Creative Commons license, so the Creative Commons attribution license, mm-hmm. is way too restrictive.
Well, and the other thing is the natural underlying legal state of the data. Mm-hmm. So, there is no creative expression in your genome. So there is no copyright. And so putting it into a database is sort of like you have a copyrighted container.
Yeah.
And you put facts into it.
Okay.
And so even if you put a Creative Commons license on the container, I can pull the facts out of the container without violating the copyright.
Yeah. So I can continue on.
Okay, so the copyright is only on, right, facts are not copyrightable. The copyright is only on a container.
Right.
So
essentially what you're saying on all of this is, as long as these are statements of biological fact within these databases, implicitly everything is within public domain. And then the question is really an access question rather than a legal status question.
Well, but you can copyright the whole container, right? I'm actually using Tim's words here. He can jump in because he did most of the legal work here on the protocol. Is that by attaching the copyright license to the facts in, of course, the scientists to figure out where the container stops and starts.
Yeah, maybe I can jump on this, and I'm sure that Tin will update and complete. So the line between Creative Commons and Science Commons legally should not be drawn by the scientists, and the scientists should not be aware or have to be aware that there is copyright on copyrightable works, which are original formalized expression, like a text, but there can also be data, which are not protected by copyright and have different statutes all over the world. And there are also databases, which have different statutes all over the world. So if you use a Creative Commons license for a database, it doesn't work at all or easily, because you would have to specify whether your license applies to the stuff which is in the database, which can be copyrightable work, but which can be data, and then it would really add restrictions where there aren't, and this is really against the goal of the commons.
The same concern with the early Creative Commons licenses of someone taking this freely accessible data and trying to relock it into copyrighted containers.
That's exactly what would happen if you take a database of data which are in the public domain, and if you add a Creative Commons license to that, you would add a layer of contractual restrictions, and it would be less open than the legal status.
Positing the hostile intent of someone essentially taking, you guys push an open data standard, you put it out there, people grab it, and then sort of package it and resell it. And I guess what I'm asking is, how does one defend against that?
Maintaining an open copy on the web elsewhere.
Yeah.
Right? Because they can't then come back and tell you to take down the public domain version.
Right.
Yeah. Because what the second one is going to be copyrighted is the arrangement of the database. So you cannot copy the full, but the 100% of the database.
Yep.
But if you keep the rest, and actually the new database can even have contractual restrictions and not just copyright restrictions. So the idea is also to maintain a repository of the open that you can copy in any team. I don't know if you want to.
So your point is well taken. And actually, it could happen. The situation is rather more complicated than even the copyright issue. Even with the copyright issue in the US, there has to be creativity. Mm-hmm. That's not true everywhere. But in Canada, the standard is there skill and judgment used in selecting the elements of the database. You go to Australia, it's sweat of the brow. You go to Europe, it's sui generis protection on top of copyright protection. So imagine a collaborative project where you have people from all around the world. Each of them may be subject to a slightly different standard on what is copyrightable. On top of that, you have the problem that countries like China are not using copyright so much to protect these things, but they have unfair competition rules too. So the answer is we don't know what rights may kick in, and the only way we can be sure is to get rid of all of them. And the differential between a CC BY license and public domain is attribution. And I've often argued that attribution should not be confused with citation. Attribution is a legal concept. Citation is a normative ethical concept. Just as copyright infringement is a legal concept, but plagiarism is an ethical concept. Sometimes the same act can do both. An act of plagiarism might be a copyright infringement, it might not. Or fair use and all things like that, but you shouldn't confuse the two. And what I would argue, this causes 80% of the problems in my view, in terms of people who want to share databases publicly. The one thing they worry about is, what if somebody takes my work and doesn't give me credit? That's what they worry about. And that's an issue about citation. And the question I would pose to all of you to think about is, what does adding a right to sue add to this issue of whether or not you get citation? Is the normative concept adequate? Or does a right to sue give you anything more? And what are the downsides of having a right to sue, especially when you have all these different laws all around the world that work differently depending on where you are and where the contributor is? So all of these, the practical solution is rely on normative concepts, ethical concepts, especially in scientific research, to get citation. But don't insist on legal attribution, because
And the other key point in this is that, and this didn't really come out so much today, is that one of built into the protocol we laid out is a recognition that this doesn't work for everyone. Not everything can go into the public domain. And so but it does tie into the project here, which is that if you can't comply, maybe it's for privacy reasons, right? Human identifiable clinical trial data can't be in the public domain, right? For reasons that are not even. of military or even corporate reasons. It's about keeping your data private so you can't be cut out of your health insurance, for example. But the idea is that you provide clear machine-readable terms of use and clear machine-readable descriptions of the kinds of information that are in your database, so that at least it is as easy as possible to discover and understand what data is available and under what terms is available. That's why Melanie collected some of this information about those terms of use. There's actually data that's not displayed here where she categorized and said, you know, do they request share alike or non-commercial and so forth. We're not displaying it because we don't want to encourage people to go down that road. But she's, you know, she's actually gone and collected that data. And in the at least in those cases, you can say, well, you know, at least give me all the non-commercial stuff. I'm going to do non-commercial research. You know, but it's funky, right? Because data is not like copyright. Every data query is a derivative data product of every database it touches. Whether or not it pulls data out of, so a Google query, every Google query is a derivative data product of every Google database that it hits. And so when you think about the Wikipedia CC versus GFDL incompatibility and scale that out to tens of thousands of databases.
I mean, it seems in a funny way.
Like, you actually have an inherent problem based on the fact that you have commons in the name of the project, which is to say that once you get your head to work around Creative Commons, right, essentially what you mentally do as a creator is say, okay, I'm going to use copyright for my own benefit. I own this, therefore I'm going to put it out as widely as possible. For those of us who are not lawyers, many of the people in the room, that intuitive break between hard-earned research data and the scribble that I put out in my email, not thinking about it, the fact that the latter has copyright and the former can't, is not an intuitive thing. And so it's very strange. My instinct as someone who's been sort of pushing for Creative Commons for a couple of years is to say, what the heck are you doing, you know, trying to release this into public domain?
I would characterize the reaction of some communities as downright angry. Geospatial and street map communities, and you say, listen, you know, you don't have copyright on the GPS traces. Right, I mean, yeah, the height of Mount Everest is the height of Mount Everest.
Yeah.
It is what it is. But you know, the fact that we're getting in and saying, you know, don't use CC licenses here.
Well, that's what I'm saying. It just seems like such a bizarre branding confusion.
But it's not where we started. We started by saying apply Creative Commons licenses to the copyrightable elements of your data, right, and waive to the others, and it didn't work.
It's too complicated.
Even lawyers can't figure it out or agree. What is the copyrightable element?
But I mean, there's a bizarre way in some ways.
John, where, you know, it almost makes sense if you guys were called something different.
Yeah.
You know, if you were the Open Science Data Project or something like that, or Public Domain Science Data Project. But, you know, when you call it Science Commons, you know, I immediately try to frame it as Creative Commons and then sort of trip over how copyright law works.
The thing you mentioned has come back at Creative Commons under the guise of CC0. You'll see a fairly huge stink about in the coming weeks, 10 months?
Months, weeks.
Sometime, right? Which is sort of the renewal of the public domain dedication to a certain extent. But that's tied up in politics that are unrelated to data and databases in some ways.
And it's also important to know that what we're discussing today, it works for databases in life science, but it may it doesn't work for databases of copyrighted and copyrightable works. So there's a lot.
Films,
yes.
The Dutch Film Archive, which was the recent.
Yes. And we have many, many European institutions who want to open up access to the databases they curated, which contain works which are not in the public domain, and so there's a lot of work to do in order to be able to advise the best tool.
So just to follow up on Ethan's question, well, I had two brief questions. First, to follow up on Ethan's question, the question of Google Maps, for example, publishes these satellite images, or I guess it's just republishing in the sense that that there are parties that provide satellite images. What is the what about that is copyrighted when it seems that it doesn't really have an artistic element? It's just about capturing representation of the world as it is and providing the most trivial possible representation. Even if it involves work, it seems that the output of that work is somehow, I mean, is that owned or like, I mean, is that,
maps
can
are
that be,
funky.
It's
maps are funky because maps display map, and their maps tend to display some copyright characteristics. Plus you can there are some protections against reaching through and getting the data up underneath the map.
We don't agree.
Navtech, and there's one other company that provide most of the content, like Garmin and Google and all the GPS companies and all of that. And they have this most amazing contract of adhesion you could possibly design. It says, you know, everything's copyrighted, but if it's not, you've signed a contract in which you agree to treat it as it's copyrighted.
And in the U.S., different from other countries, there was like a switch in the law some time ago declaring that maps are copyrighted. Wendy, what is this phase?
The problem there, though, is make an argument that if you were to gain access to the Navtech database and extract the latitudes and longitudes and republish them, that you might have a copyright case you could stand on. There's a chance there, right? But they are so aggressive in tracking users, and the contract provisions they've attached are so powerful that, you know, no one would ever do it. Whereas if you put it on, like, there's an OpenStreetMap consortium that uses a CC license, right? They don't track who the user is. So I could download it in a cyber cafe in India, and give it on a flash drive to Ethan sitting next to me, and he could re-upload it, right? And there's a very good chance that data would then be in the public domain despite. Because the open license, building an open platform on a contract of adhesion is a bad idea. Contracts of adhesion only work for closed, not platforms.
And I guess my second question was a follow-up to Jim's question from earlier, which was scientific community, when people in the scientific or engineering communities publish papers, often there are restrictions on the papers based upon the journals or the conferences that have copyright over the contents. But nonetheless, it seems that many scientists actually republish their papers on their own personal websites.
Yes.
Or on the websites of the university, et cetera. And
yeah.
and perhaps when you referred to Stuart Cheever's work, it seems like that's a declaration in some sense that Harvard is going to do this. What does that imply for looking backward? What is it that the copyright owners gain when all of this scientific work is just going to be, republished anyway?
I will go even one step backwards and rephrase your question, if I understand correctly. The copyright owner, the initial one, it's not the journal, it's the scientists, it's the author.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes scientists, researchers think, oh no, I can't publish it online, or I do it anyway, but the journal owns the rights on my research. This is not true. This is a contractual assignment decided on the publishing policy of a journal. But the initial author, the initial rights holder on an article, it's the author. And so several institutions, including Science Commons, developed plugins that you can add to the publishing agreement in order to retain your rights, and indeed in order to allow scientists to publish their article on their own website, on their university institutional repository, or on a thematic repository. And so this can be a decision which can happen at various levels. So either the individual level of the author who wish to retain her rights or to publish in an open access journal, so the green model, or to just do it regardless of what is contractually authorized or not. And there is also the other layer to act at the level of the funder or of the university. And then we come back to funder's policy or university policies requiring or recommending researchers to upload their paper as soon as possible in a repository, and the same could happen to data.
Do you know of any research that's looking into the future of journals, the future role of journals in this space? I mean, if everyone is in many scientific communities are simply browsing their colleagues' web pages and finding the papers that are interesting, and that's how research is carried out, then the role of journal as a distribution mechanism has been degraded somehow. But nonetheless, we still depend upon the vetting to indicate what papers are interesting to us at some level. So
also important for branding, for career, for evaluation issues, and indeed the question of open access to publications is quite complex. It involves scientific evaluation factors, economic issues, because who does the peer review in a journal, either open access or non-open access? The researchers, for free. But there is added value by the journal, like the brand, the copy editing, etc. But indeed, many researchers look for work not in the library, not in the journal, but online. So it's a whole new set of perspectives to access data and to find the best possible ways to disseminate it. Other questions? I think we can take one or two other questions before closing.
Of sociology, I see a lot of this stuff with sociological data, like things carried out as surveys, stuff like that. But as someone who's currently writing, or actually rewriting, one of these same surveys, it seems like there's a fair amount of creativity that goes into it. So I was wondering what the legal implications of that were versus like having an open comment, because I mean, it seems like it'd be a good idea.
Do you mean if you have an incentive to open the data that you are currently working on, that you spend time to gather, because you would like to be the first one to publish an article about the data that you collected? Is that your question?
How would the fact that sociological research tends to be much more crafted, the questions tend to be much more crafted, how does that change science common? I mean, that's kind of a broad question.
Yeah, I guess it's both a cultural questions, because communities, scientific communities, as you already said, have different behaviors and cultures regarding sharing of data. And the legal answer would be either your sociological data are works, copyright, either they are data, and then there's no copyrights applying to them. So I'm not really sure that I'm...
Do you mean the survey or the answers to the survey? Because the survey might well have some creativity and copyright associated with it, but it's not very valuable if you don't tell people what questions you ask. So, you know, but the numbers of responses to that would be sort of the data in this context. But this goes back to Tim's point, which is, the reason that most people do science is to get credit for their work, for doing original work, and to write papers about it. And one of the unintended consequences of Creative Commons success has been that we pile all sorts of things into the Creative Commons bucket, including things that didn't used to be legal things, like citation and credit. And so we've now merged that with the idea of attribution, which carries with this very complex right to sue, right? And the question is, you know, is that good? And, you know, in the abstract, it might be hard to answer that question, but in the context of science, if your goal is to actually stitch together the outputs of five different projects, it's very clear that the answer is that, that even attribution is bad. Because it, let's say you have different wording about attribution because you have five different open licenses on five different data sets. You can't put them together now. Or let's say you'd like to take some sociological research about methamphetamine abuse and put that together with research about domestic violence in a rural area. In the presence of conflicting share-alike terms on those things, you can't stitch them together legally because the output would have to be licensed under both.
Never mind, you'd have to go through crazy IRB approval.
Right. And so what
you're not
counting
all the rest.
You know, a lot of the stuff that Creative Commons did, it's really easy compared to sort of complex data integration, much less complex computational science and the kind of work. So the thesis behind all of this is interoperability and getting scientific norms out of the law and vice versa. That's really what this is about. And that lets each different discipline come up with their own norms. Right, whereas a contract actually imposes the same norms on anyone, and it doesn't allow any flexibility for the physicist to have different norms than the sociologist, because probably they ought to have different norms.
Do we have one more question? Yes?
I just wanted to say, when you say each discipline will come up with its own norm, what are you going to do in science, where you've got biologists running over to the people who are doing MEMS? And they're essentially engineers, and there are physicists with them too. So you've got three different disciplines working.
You have to let them negotiate that as scientists.
So,
it's hard enough without
scientists.
Lawyers. Well, project by project, but I mean, if you look at sort of the history of the way these have developed, there's sort of it's unclear, and then a big project gets it right, and everyone copies them. So the Human Genome Project developed the Bermuda Rule. After 8 years of disagreements about how to share human genome, and the NIH basically mailed them all off to Bermuda for 3 days and said, "Don't come back till you figure it out." And when they came back, as they said, "Everything's in the public domain 24 hours after it comes off the machine." But the people that put the data into the public domain retain the right to publish first on a certain piece of the information, and the people that violated that didn't get a lot more grants. Because their peers reviewed their new papers and their grant applications. And so they self-regulated pretty effectively. It wasn't perfect.
So that's for the really big projects where it pays to have sort of more formal ways of scientists interacting. But on the smaller projects, what I've seen is it depends where you're going to publish and where the journal you're going to publish in, those are the norms you follow. So everybody just kind of falls in line from that.
The publishers actually reinforced the norm project by requiring this, if you're going to publish about a gene, you've got to include the accession number of the database provided by the US government. And you couldn't get that without putting the gene sequence in the public domain. So the publishers really played a very powerful reinforcing role.
So what you're saying is there's legal precedent.
There's social precedent.
Social
the idea
precedent
is to prevent the emergence of legal
precedent.
Legal
precedent.
Well, that's last resort.
Yeah.
All right, I think that's terrific talk and good conversation afterwards.
Thank you.